So this week we're doing Genesis 44:45. Joseph forgives his brother. Before I get to that, I want to dwell on something I did last week. This is for a lady who's not here today, by the way. Diana was here, and she made a point, and I missed it. But I want to correct something about Reuben. When Reuben says to his brothers, "I told you not to do it," he did say that. He did accuse them when they were all going, "Oh, it's God getting even with us." Yeah, I mean, he did talk them into throwing him in a pit, and he intended, remember, to go back and get him and take him back to his father. And then he goes away. And in the narrative, we don't know where he goes. There's no indication where he went. But when he comes back, they've already sold Joseph off into slavery. So now he's stuck. Being the one brother who did plan to save Joseph, but then he didn't because he was gone, he did have to agree to be part of the scheme to bloody the robe and say, "Father, our son has been murdered, killed by an animal." I missed that last week, and I just want to say, you know, sometimes I do miss things. I just want to let you know that things didn't really go the way I planned them, and sometimes they don't. The other thing I didn't even bring up at all, I think, which is important, is that he bypasses Reuben and keeps Simeon in jail. He lets Reuben go back. Reuben's the oldest, and he's the one that would be considered the most responsible. But he lets him go and he takes Simeon because he knows who wanted to throw him in the pit and who didn't. I think Simeon is the second one. That's why he keeps him. He's the next in line. I think that's the only reason. Because I think he realizes Reuben really wasn't the one who wanted to throw him into the pit or to kill him. He tried to save him. Well, anyway, that's enough of that. Joseph forgives his brothers. The question before the house today: what does Joseph's final test of his brothers reveal? Now, I'm going to be honest here. I'm only looking for one thing. And once I get it, we're going to move on. The hint's in the title. This is what he wants them to see. Putting the cup in Benjamin's bag, the thing he wants them to know is that he has forgiven them. That the forgiveness is already there. But what's the problem? They didn't see it. They don't see it. They don't experience it. They can't accept it because of what's in their hearts. He doesn't want to just send them away to their father without them knowing who he is. And them knowing that no matter what they've done to him, he's forgiven them already. Even they don't know they're forgiven. That A, he wants them to experience the forgiveness that he has already determined. He's already made a decision. I will not ever hold this against these brothers. We're going to read through this narrative. A couple points I want you to see. Their repentance is real. Then you know that because you no longer see any jealousy. We saw that last week. No jealousy for Benjamin. No greed. And we see here that their repentance is real because their loyalty really is to Jacob and Benjamin. They tear their clothes, and now their forgiveness will mean a lot because they know what they are wrong. And they admit among each other that they are wrong. They're admitting it to themselves first. So let's go through the narrative. Let's look at this, see what happens. Joseph sets the trap. The trap is 44:2, when he says to the house steward, "Go ahead, fill their sacks up, put the money in their sacks, put the silver cup in the youngest one, and then say this to them when you catch up to them." The servant's got to be wondering, what's he doing? I mean, he's got to be wondering why he's having him do this. "But isn't this the cup my master drinks from and also uses for divination? This is a wicked thing you've done, stealing his cup." So there's the trap. Why would he say divination? They still think he's an Egyptian. And how do Egyptians try to determine facts about things and events and other people? He's not tipping his hand. You know, what he's essentially saying is, I can read the past. So I think this is very smart on his part. Judah steps forward and he becomes a spokesman very early here. And he says, "Look, if any of us have this thing, then he's going to die. Then the rest of us will be your slaves. He'll die and the rest of us will come back because we don't think your accusation is true." And so this is a rash promise. And this is a promise that should remind you of another rash promise that got made before around the same thing, the idols of divination. When Laban comes in, says, "You've stolen my household gods." And these are the things they would use to divine the future and bring blessing on the house. And so Rachel had stolen the idols of the house, which are the center of blessing for the house. Now, remember now, this is among people who really believe in God too. So it's a kind of a mix of beliefs here. And so it's like Jacob's condemned Rachel by what he said. Well, it's a rash promise based on not knowing all the facts. He says, "Very well, go ahead, Let it be as you say. Whoever's found to be to have this cup, this is what the servant says back to Judah. I won't kill him, but I'll make him my slave. And the rest of you, you're going to go home. I'm not going to keep you. So if I find this cup, that person's going to become a slave. The rest of you can leave. So he has really set them free. So they don't have to stay behind. That's why he does that. Well, as they search everybody, they start with the oldest, they get down to the youngest, and lo and behold, they find the cup in Benjamin's sack. They show their grief. They tear their clothes, they load their donkeys, and they all go back. That's in light of the fact he's told them they can go home. This is a real mark here that they realize they're guilty and they repented. They're not going to leave him. They're not going to abandon him. They're not going to say, oh, we didn't know he stole it, but he must have, so go ahead, take him. We're leaving. They don't do that. They don't turn their back on him. And they don't suspect any fraud. They don't suspect a setup. They don't know whether he's stolen it or not. They don't suspect any more than Jacob suspected them when they brought them Joseph's coat. He didn't suspect them of murdering him or selling them off. He's totally in the dark. They don't accuse him. They just pack up. They go back. I can imagine that going back, their heads hanging. They're going, how did this happen? I mean, why did this have to happen to us? They get back. Here's what Joseph says. What have you done? Don't you know that a man like me, in my position, I'm second only to Pharaoh, to the king? Don't you know I can find things out by divination? Don't you know I can read the past and the future? You think I wouldn't know that you took that cup and that I wouldn't look for it? And Judah says, what can we say? What can we possibly say? How can we prove our innocence? God has uncovered our guilt. We are now your slaves. All of us. We're all your slaves. So look what Judah says. God has uncovered our guilt. Now what's he talking about? He knows they're not guilty of two things. They're not guilty of being spies. And Judah certainly is not guilty of stealing. But he says, our guilt. He doesn't say you've uncovered his guilt and point to Benjamin. He's collectively saying our guilt. All of a sudden, the lights come on. He knows. He knows what we did to our brother. So Joseph says to them, only the man who is found to have the cup will become my slave. The rest of you, go back to your father in peace. So here, they get the second offer to go back. You don't have to suffer any consequence of what he did. Now, starting in verse 18, here's where Judah recounts the whole story again, telling how we came up and we went back and our father wouldn't let us come back. We finally talked him into it. He let us bring Benjamin. He goes through the whole story again. He comes down to 31 and he says, if the boy's not with us, when I go back to my father, then he will die. He will die. We will bring the gray head of our father down to the grave in sorrow. It'll kill him if we go back without Benjamin. And he knows the old man's sorrow that he's been living with for all these years, and he does not want to be the one to cause this. So he's saying, we're not going back. And he goes on to say that, I guaranteed that boy's safety. I said, if I do not bring him back to you, I will bear the blame all my life, that I'm putting myself in his place. Now, this is what he says to Joseph. That's what Joseph needs to hear. This is the moral high point of Judah's life. Remember, we saw Judah at a low point, not only selling off his brother, but then going into his son's wife and having a child, an act of immorality. You look at in chapter 38, how much lower can this guy go? And that's where his repentance began. Remember, she's righteous, I'm not. Is it real? Yes. And this is the moral high point of his life. Judah is offering himself as a substitute for Benjamin. You keep me, let him go home. Plead with him, please, let me remain here as a slave in place of the boy. Let the boy return with his brothers. Let him go home. Do not let me see the misery that would come upon my father. I can't go back there without him. Joseph can't take it anymore. He has seen now that they are admitting how wrong they are and that they want to be forgiven. And he begins to weep so loudly, the Egyptians hear him, is what the text says. And he cries out to them now. He says, I'm Joseph. Is my father still living? He knows the answer to that from what Judah just says, but he wants to hear it again. Then Joseph says, come close to me. I'm your brother Joseph, the one whom you sold into Egypt. This is the first time they have any inkling who this is. This has to hit them harder than anything they've ever experienced. And when he reveals himself, they are afraid. Because what would you expect this brother you sold into slavery to do? To take vengeance, especially the position he's in. I mean, I think it all hits him all of a sudden right now. He's engineered this whole thing to get us back here. He did this to get us back here to kill us. But he says, no, that's not it at all. He says, don't be angry for sending me here, because you didn't send me here. God sent me here ahead of you. And he says again, God sent me. Verse 5, 7, and 8, God sent me. And in 8, it was not you who sent me, but God. He sent me. And he does that because he wants to assure them that they're safe, that they are forgiven. They have been forgiven. They remain forgiven. They will be forgiven in the future. They are forgiven forever. That's what he wants them to know. Will they accept his forgiveness, knowing who he is? That's a real turning point in this whole narrative. He says to them, hurry back to my father. Say to him, this is what your son Joseph says. God has made me Lord of all Egypt. Come down to me. Don't delay. Go get him and bring him back. And he says to them, you will live in the region of Goshen. And Goshen is the best part of Egypt. It's right up by Ramses. It's north of Memphis. And it's very lush land. It's perfect for someone who raises sheep and cattle that needs grazing land. And he threw his arms around Benjamin then. And Benjamin embraces him back. And they're both standing there crying. Benjamin has not seen his brother since he was a little boy. And then he kissed all of his brothers and wept over them. He wants them now to come down and be with him in the best area of Egypt. And now's when he tells them there's 5 years of famine left. You know, I really do know the future. But it's not through the cup of divination. It's through the revelation of God. The same way I knew that you would come down here and bow before me. This is the guy that told us the dream. We would all come down here and bow before him, and we did that. Where do we see this before? The kissing and the weeping where you don't expect it. Jacob and Esau. Jacob and Esau. See, what you want to see with Jacob and Esau is that kind of forgiveness can only come through a work of God in a person's heart. And so what does that make you think of Esau? It colors his whole character, doesn't it? See, he's able to do, this is real love and forgiveness. This is the real thing. And so this is full reconciliation here. Only possible with forgiveness. Forgiveness is only possible with the acceptance of God's sovereignty. And that's what Joseph has done. He fully accepts God's sovereignty. He then fully forgives. And when the time is right, he's able to express that forgiveness, which brings peace. Who is it that they make peace, but there's no forgiveness in our narrative in Genesis? Laban and Jacob. They make peace, but is there forgiveness? You can have forgiveness. Does that mean there's automatically going to bring peace? No, because the person you're trying to forgive may say, I don't need forgiveness. I'm your enemy. I don't need your forgiveness. But can you have reconciliation without forgiveness? Real biblical forgiveness? No. Are we willing to forgive, even though the person we forgive rejects us and will not recognize that our forgiveness is there? Pharaoh now comes in. And now this to me is absolutely amazing. This is almost uncanny. This, you can't explain this at all. He hears that his brothers are down. He thinks this is great. He says, tell your brothers, load your animals, bring them all down to Canaan. I will give them the best land in the land of Egypt. Don't worry about their belongings. Because just bring them all down here. They got the best of everything. We're going to take care of them. This is Pharaoh's idea. Joseph doesn't ask him to do this. He comes up with this on his own. I think this is just uncanny. I think this is a God thing. So Joseph sends his brothers on their way. Loads them down with wagons full of stuff to take back to Jacob. And you know what he tells them? I mean, he could see the kind of thing they would get into. But I think he tells them this because he doesn't want them to quarrel. He wants them to think about what they're going to do. What kind of discussion they had on the way home over days and days and days in this caravan? What do you think their main question is? How are we going to explain this? Don't be pointing fingers at each other. You think of how you're going to communicate this to your father, because he knows they've got a lot to tell him that he doesn't know. Well, they get down there. They tell him that Joseph is still alive. In fact, he's the ruler of all Egypt. He's in charge of everything. Jacob, it says, is stunned. He didn't believe them. I think in between 26 and 28, they have to convince him that they're not lying. How do they have to convince him that they're not lying? My son Joseph is still alive. That's the conviction he has. They convince him of it. And they told Jacob, you sold him, but it was God's plan. And that had to be a blow to Jacob. I'm sure it took him a while for this to soak in. What he's saying when he says, it is enough, I'm convinced my son Joseph is alive. So once he sees Joseph is alive, now you got another layer of the story. You're touching on it. He has to forgive them. Once he realizes that my son is alive and it was God that caused it, I must forgive these boys for what they did. And this isn't a family that's prone to forgiveness. You know, we've already established that. He's going to forgive them. That is amazing. When you go back, all the way back to the beginning of the narrative of Joseph, the brothers hate him. The brothers hate him and want to kill him. And that hatred is not only for him, it's for Jacob. Because Jacob is treating him as a favorite. What they don't see is that he's God's favorite. Joseph is God's favorite. And that's what they're rebelling against. But we go through this too. We are not forgiving people generally. But you know, God calls Christians to be forgiving. Why? Because we know that Jesus is alive, and he is alive having died on the cross because we are forgiven. We are forgiven. We don't seek to be forgiven. We are forgiven. And when a Christian sins, until we go to Christ and admit it, we don't experience the forgiveness that he already has there. But forgiveness equals reconciliation. Without forgiveness, there cannot be reconciliation. Joseph let God be in charge. Without complaint, he really believed what Paul wrote later on, that all things are working together for good. Now Jacob has to take the same attitude, and he must surrender to God's plan, and he's got to go to Egypt. But here's the thing about forgiveness and reconciliation. True forgiveness is not possible without the recognition and acceptance of God's sovereignty. I'm God's favorite. You can literally say that, because we are favorite of God, and the world hates that. And we see an example here that people who are living in the flesh will hate those who they think God is blessing more than they should be blessed. Not that I want what they have, but I don't think that person deserves this kind of blessing. Look at this. We're going to go back to the beginning. Here comes the dreamer. Let's kill him. Throw him into the cistern. Then we'll see what comes of his dreams. What are his dreams? They're prophetic statements about what God is going to do through him. Look at this. These are the leaders of his people, his brothers, his elders. He's worthy of death. Look at this. What did Jesus say in that court that day? He says, you're going to see me coming on the clouds. He's speaking Daniel 7, prophecy. The Messiah is going to come in the clouds of heaven. And what's Jesus going to do? Zechariah 12. Notice how the inhabitants of Jerusalem, who are Jews, who are going to be there on the day Jesus returns in his glory, look at their reaction when they see who he is. Similar to what we just read, isn't it? Because Jesus is condemned by his people, but he has forgiven his people. And Israel is forgiven by Jesus already, but they will see that forgiveness in the future when he comes back. And the great secret in all this is right here. What you intended for evil, the Lord intended for good. When they crucified him, that will lead to what he will do in the future. All things work together. God's got it all worked out. When you see that God's got everything worked out and somebody hurts you and you hold to God's sovereignty and not your own self-preservation, you can say, I forgive them. And you may still hurt and you may still feel like not forgiving them, but you know that feeling will change too. And maybe someday they will accept that forgiveness. Just as Israel will in the future. Notice their response when they see him. They're going to see what they did as a nation, and they're going to weep as a result. And he's going to gather them together and reign as their king. And that's what we're looking forward to. And that's as real as those brothers going back and bowing down before Joseph. God said that was going to happen, and he made it happen. This is going to happen. And it could happen in the relatively near future. We don't know when this is going to happen. It doesn't have to be 2,000 years from now. It could be 10 years from now. Easily. So we just say, come, Lord Jesus. Maranatha, come and take us out of here. That's our hope. Jacob's not going to go to heaven, but he is going to go to Egypt. And that's where we're going to meet next week, 46 through 48. Go through this whole thing. And the question is going to be, not so much a question, but a contrast. Contrast Jacob's family with the Egyptian people. Pastor Bill, you want Pastor Bill to pray? Let's have Pastor Bill pray.